Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, we'll be given a rare behind-the-scenes glimpse inside the Vatican. Will the remaining parts of the Berlin Wall pay the price of progress? The economic crisis encourages Spaniards to learn English and Greeks to join... laughter clubs. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Cardinals arrived in Rome this week prior to attending the conclave to elect the next pope. The election, which will be held by secret ballot, will take place in a closed-door meeting inside the Sistine Chapel. Preparations have already begun to house and feed the 115 cardinals who will be voting. Megan Williams was given a rare behind-the-scenes glimpse of inside the Vatican and takes us on this tour.
The bells of St. Peter's chime out 10 o'clock on a crisp, sunny morning. I'm making my way around the massive basilica walls inside Vatican City. I'm here for the small Inside the Vatican tour of key locations of the coming conclave.
Okay, could we move on? Because
our guide is the robust, gray-haired Benedikt Steinschulte of the Pontifical Council for Social Communication. He leads us up a small incline to the Santa Marta complex. This is where the 115 princes of the church, otherwise known as cardinals, will stay for the duration of the conclave. The long, low, rather plain edifice was constructed in the 90s under the pontificate of John Paul II. Steinschulte says it's a vast improvement over previous cardinal accommodation.
It has been built for the conclave of 2005, because I think in the conclave in 1978, in summertime, it was not so comfortable. For every 10 old men, only one bathroom.
Now, each room comes equipped with its own bathroom.
A 3-star, 4-star hotel. It's not luxury, but it's good material, I would say. No?
Single bed?
I don't know the rooms. These are rooms for single persons.
It may deserve 3 or 4 stars, but Steinschulte says the rooms don't come with TVs or radios. That's because Vatican law dictates that during the conclave, the cardinals have to remain cut off from the rest of the world. But there is a large dining room and cafe, so cardinals can have an espresso or cappuccino to keep them awake for the long hours of voting. And, of course, for this particular crowd, there's one other essential amenity, a chapel.
There's a chapel. Some people do pray, yeah.
Sometimes a cup of coffee helps.
Yes, this is very true.
Steinschulte points to where he witnessed the cardinals heading to the last conclave.
I remember my office was over there, the last window of this yellow building. I remember the cardinals walking to the Sistine Chapel. They took this way. Some walked on foot, the younger ones, and the older ones, in a small bus. They blocked the traffic here. For half an hour, they walked there, and then life was normal again. And for lunch, the same way back. Very normal. For a conclave, very normal.
On foot, we take the same route the cardinals soon will, about 300 meters past a Vatican gas pump where employees can fill up for cheap, around a roundabout, and further uphill to the room where popes are elected. So here, where are we?
There is the Sistine Chapel. You know, this is a castle, typically Italian castle of the 13th century.
And so the cardinals come from down there.
Yeah.
And where do they enter into?
There are some courtyards, and then they enter inside. You know, they have to do some steps because the chapel is not on the ground floor.
Since 1455, cardinals have been making their way up the five flights of stairs to vote in the famed chapel, whose splendid ceiling was painted by Michelangelo. Today, they have the option of an elevator. A short minibus ride to the top of the Vatican Hill takes us to the convent where Benedict, now Pope Emeritus, will retire in a few months. Workers are busy hauling bricks and trimming hedges.
This is the convent for the Pope. There's an older part, and this is the newer part of the monastery. It has been built by John Paul II for 8 nuns from 8 different nations. They left in November.
So no one's in them now?
No, they are working inside.
And it'll be just the Pope in there? Or
the Pope and the four ladies, the housekeepers and the secretaries, and his personal secretary.
Not to mention his beloved cats. The convent is attached to a medieval wall with giant cacti and flaming red bougainvillea growing up its side. A newer chapel with a small stained glass window and a sturdy travertine cross on top flanks one side. The convent itself is a narrow brick, three-story structure with a trellised rooftop balcony offering heavenly view. St. Peter's cupola, the Sistine Chapel, and the splendor of Rome with its palms and towering pines spread out beyond.
Look, if you go a little bit to the left-hand side here.
Our guide points out the elaborate, winding Vatican Gardens, where Benedict will soon spend time strolling, and in all likelihood, stopping to exchange greetings with another pope, his soon-to-be-elected successor, the first time in centuries that two popes meet, quietly making history under the bright Roman sunshine. Megan Williams, DW, Inside Vatican City.
Regina Celi, Lenare, Alleluia, Quia cremeruisti portare, Alleluia, Resurrexit, Sicut dixit.
The Berlin Wall was the most tangible symbol of the Cold War. Most Germans hated it. And when the communist government in the East opened up the border to the West in 1989, people came from across Europe to swing their sledgehammers and tear down the wall bit by bit. The German capital has come a long way since then, but an attempt to tear down part of the wall's biggest remaining stretch has hit a raw nerve. Berliners hated the wall, but they don't want to forget it, as we hear from Andrew Bowen.
In 1987, Ronald Reagan stood in front of the Berlin Wall and uttered the four most famous words of his presidency.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Who could have guessed that nearly 26 years later, thousands of Berliners would be cheering a different slogan?
Mr. Wolverine, keep this wall up!
That was a speaker at a recent demonstration talking to Berlin Mayor Klaus Wowereit. The protest was in support of the East Side Gallery, the longest remaining stretch of the Berlin Wall. It's now covered in murals, painted by various artists, and it's a major tourist attraction. An average 2,000 people visit it every day. But city officials and developers have been planning to remove about 23 meters of the wall and relocate it nearby. Why? Well, the East Side Gallery is so long that there are hardly any points where you can cross over from the street to the grassy area behind the wall along the Spree River. And that's a problem for developers who want to build a high-rise luxury apartment complex on the riverbank.
To me, it's ludicrous.
That's Hannah Hasenbegovic. She's 25 and lives in Berlin, in the same neighborhood as the East Side Gallery. She says the development plans next to the monument make no sense.
To me, it does not fit in with the cityscape, and also it seems very insensitive.
Insensitive because the area between the wall and the river was part of the so-called Death Strip. East German police would shoot at anyone trying to escape through the wall into West Berlin. The historical significance of the site is the main reason why so many people want it to stay untouched. There are other wall-related tourist sites in Berlin, like Checkpoint Charlie, the famous old border crossing point. But the costumed border guards and the throngs of tourists nowadays make it feel a little tacky. The East Side Gallery, on the other hand, feels authentic, and the fact that people are even thinking about putting a hole in it baffles Maria Noke, Deputy Director of the Berlin Wall Foundation.
I think the former border area where the Berlin Wall ran is not meant for property speculation or obtaining revenue for the city. This is an historic area that divided the city for more than 28 years, with significance not just for Berlin, but for the whole world. You can't just give it away to build a pretty house.
After the most recent protest, developers announced a temporary halt to the demolition work on the wall. They're planning a public forum on the project later this month. Franz Schulz is the neighborhood mayor. He says while the East Side Gallery is a protected landmark, it wasn't always that way.
Und dazu kommt, dass in den 90er Jahren Berlin ja insgesamt wenig von der Mauer hielt.
In the 1990s, Berlin as a whole thought very little of the wall. It was a disturbing barrier that people tried to get rid of as fast as possible. And against that backdrop, the city designated the space between the wall and the river as an area to build new things.
Schulz has been accused of not doing enough to protect the East Side Gallery and its surroundings. But he told protesters this week that he's on their side, and they have to do more than just protest if they want to achieve their goals.
That's not possible with the neighborhood alone. We need the support of Berlin city government.
The company planning the high-rise building says it doesn't need the hole in the East Side Gallery, and that city officials were the ones to request it. But even if the wall stays untouched, the plans for the luxury apartment complex are still on track. Protesters want the city to buy back the land and offer developers an alternative site. But riverfront property is prime real estate, and any changes to the project would be very expensive. Andrew Bowen, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And I'm Helen Senian Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Spaniards are the first to admit that they're poor linguists and that they've struggled when it comes to learning English. But as the country's economic crisis continues and more Spaniards look abroad for their future, the learning of other languages has become increasingly important. Guy Hedgeco reports from Madrid.
This may sound like just another noisy bar in central Madrid, but in fact there's some serious learning going on here. All the people crammed in here want to improve either their Spanish or their English.
My name is Nathan Vermarian. I'm the manager of Spanglish Exchange, which is a language exchange events company. We're here tonight at Beerlingual, which is our bilingual pub quiz.
Okay, question number two. What's Mars's nickname? ¿Cuál es el apodo de Marte?
General knowledge questions are asked in Spanish and English, and contestants gather in groups to discuss the answers in whichever language they're trying to improve.
A lot of people are always looking for classes, but what happens is they get bored and they give up because they're tired of level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and we found that people, they always wanted to find someone to speak with in English or in Spanish or whatever language they were trying to learn, but they just didn't have the means to do that.
There are Americans, Irish and British people here, all hoping to improve their Spanish. But there are also lots of Spaniards, such as Carlos López, working on their English.
It's a good way, a very fun way to learn English. Here in Madrid, it's difficult to speak English with people. It's difficult because nobody in Spain knows English.
Carlos may be exaggerating when he says nobody in Spain speaks English, but there is an element of truth in what he's saying. Here, there has traditionally been a problem when it comes to learning the language.
If you speak to a Spaniard, they'll often say that their English is so bad because their English teachers, when they were young, couldn't speak the language. They taught them the grammar of the language straight from books, and they never actually got to use it.
Edward Marx runs a language academy in Madrid. He believes the four-decade dictatorship of Francisco Franco also played a factor in hindering the learning of languages.
Spain was closed off to the rest of the world for so long. And even when it opened after the death of Franco, there are certain things which didn't change. For example, in television and cinema, films are still dubbed.
And yet now things are changing. A recent poll showed that over a third of Spaniards would give up sex for a year if it meant they could speak fluent English. And Spain's Federation of Language Academies says that each year the number of language students is doubling, with English being by far the most popular subject. Spain's deep economic crisis is seen as a major reason for this. With youth unemployment at over 55%, more and more young people are looking abroad for a professional future. There are signs that the next generation of Spanish professionals will have a strong grasp of English, and this school I'm standing next to is one reason why. It's one of the Madrid region's public bilingual schools, set up in the last few years to ensure that children learn different school subjects in Spanish and English. The bilingual schools have now spread across Spain, but hundreds of private academies have also sprung up to satisfy Spaniards' newfound hunger for English. And it seems to be working. A study by EF, a language training firm, showed that in 2009, Spaniards were the worst English speakers in Europe. But in the most recent report, they had moved several places up the index, leapfrogging the likes of France, Italy and Portugal.
This is a pig. Is it a thin pig or a fat pig?
Fat.
It's a fat pig.
At Edward Marx's academy, Building English, the emphasis is on cutting-edge interactive learning techniques.
Spaniards are getting better at English. People who had a basic level are working to improve it. People who had absolutely no level are striving to learn. And people with kids are making sure that their kids are brought up speaking it.
Spain may not be a linguistic powerhouse yet, but people here are increasingly determined to make sure that as well as speaking the language of Cervantes, they can also speak the language of Shakespeare. Guy Hedgeco, DW, Madrid.
Panda bear or polar bear?
Polar bear.
Polar bear, good.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
By George, she's got it. By George, she's got it. Now once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that soggy plain?
Well, the economic crisis has also resulted in an interesting new trend in Greece. As we hear from Anthi Karasava in Athens, people are turning to laughter to get them through these tough times.
Huddled inside a nondescript basement in central Athens, a group of wildly diverse strangers work up a sweat. They start off gently raising their hands up to the sky. They breathe in. They breathe out. And then... Greece's financial crisis is no laughing matter. But 3 years into a recession that has squeezed incomes by as much as 60%, increased the number of suicides by 40%, and driven more than a million to unemployment lines, Greeks are grappling with ways to remain sane, now turning to what some call a free cure to just about any ailment, laughter. Take Dionysis Kalinikos. At age 27, he's already broke. He's locked more time out of work than on the job. And while smiley and optimistic by nature, he admits he needs a place to vent.
A friend of mine and I were looking for activities to do without having to pay the cost of enrollment fees. We checked into the Athens Laughter Club about a year ago, and ever since my life has changed. As soon as I feel myself sinking into despair, I crack even the tiniest of smiles. And that helps kick in a feel-good emotion that somehow just wipes out any and every shred of negativity.
Pioneered by a physician in India just under a decade ago, laughter yoga is starting to take Greece by storm. Clubs are sprouting around the country like Tupperware parties. There's no centralized direction, and just about anyone who's had a session or two can become a laughing guru. Among them, Ritsa, a 51-year-old former banker who lost her job of 29 years at the height of the Greek crisis.
It's true, hearty laughter has disappeared from our life. Misery and depression are sweeping across society. Even those who aren't directly affected start to ache and feel depressed just by turning on the radio or TV and listening to the news.
On a cold, damp day this month, Rita led the club's session reiterating rules to newcomers like myself. There's no trace of traditional humour, she said. No jokes, no amusing stories. Pregnant women, and not surprisingly, those suffering from hemorrhoids are not allowed to take part. Instead, the focus is on simple, improvised exercises meant to get the laughter rolling. Hands clapping. And voices chanting. So for 45 minutes in this session, members pranced around the concrete floor, flapped their arms like chickens, rode imaginary giggle bikes, and even exhaled in long, deep breaths, looking and sounding like depressing balloons. The most popular exercises, though, are those closest linked to Greek reality. In the empty pockets routine, for example, members point to their penniless pockets and fake out a laugh to overcome despair and widespread discontent.
The goal is to take these exercises into daily life, into reality, so that if and when your pockets are empty or you can't pay the bills, you cope with the situation better. If that isn't what's needed here today, then what is?
Just how healthy laughter yoga is remains unclear. The thought also that it can help solve Greece's problems sounds surreal, critics say. But proof or no proof, this upcoming stress-busting trend here is proving no joking matter. Not at least for newfound fans like Dionysi.
Learning to laugh at my problems has been the best antidote to this crisis.
Antikarasava, DW, Athens.
Well, I hope that gave you a giggle. Don't forget to drop us a line if you have a comment or query on the program. Our email address is europe@dw.de. That's europe@dw.de. Or put pen to paper the old-fashioned way, add a stamp and address the envelope to Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We'd love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, the drama of the Bolshoi spills over into real life.
This last incident, this horrible attack with the sulfuric acid on Sergei Filin, is of course worse than all the previous incidents, but it definitely does cast a serious shadow over the reputation of the Bolshoi.
Also on Inside Europe, will curfews keep Swiss kids on the straight and narrow? How Stalin remains a hometown hero, and rapping for peace in the Congo. Those stories and more coming up. One of the Bolshoi Ballet's leading male dancers has confessed to ordering an acid attack on the company's artistic director in January. Pavel Dmitrychenko was detained on Tuesday over the crime. He was allegedly angry that his partner, a fellow dancer, was missing out on leading roles. The Bolshoi's artistic director, Sergei Filin, had sulfuric acid thrown in his face and nearly lost his eyesight. Even in a country where the violent settling of scores is not uncommon, the attack shocked people. It's also blackened the reputation of the renowned Bolshoi Theatre. Our Moscow correspondent, Gert Kerkamp, told me more.
They're having mixed reactions, in fact. On the one hand, of course, shock, because it's, Dmitrychenko is a well-known dancer. He's been with the Bolshoi Ballet for more than 10 years, and of course, he had the leading role in Ivan the Terrible ballet. On the other hand, you get reactions such as, well, it's not surprising that things like this happen inside the Bolshoi Theatre because it has been something like a hornet's nest for many years already with all kinds of threats and people threatening each other, people hating each other, jealousy, etc., etc. So that sooner or later something like this would happen is not a surprise to people who know something about what's happening inside the walls of the Bolshoi Theatre.
Well, I mean, Bolshoi Ballet has been an enduring symbol of Russian culture for centuries. What impact has this attack and now the confession, what impact are they having on its reputation?
Oh, it will have a disastrous impact, for sure. And this is not the first case which has cast a shadow on the Bolshoi. Over the past years, we've seen various well-known dancers or people working in the Bolshoi leaving the theatre because of all these inside intrigues and plots and conspiracies. Some 10 years ago, it was the famous ballet dancer Anastasia Volochkova, who, by the way, now says that she's not convinced that the what we know now about Dmitrychenko's role in this attack, that this is the whole story, maybe much more about it. She says there's a whole mafia around the Bolshoi and we just don't know exactly what happened. And more recently, a few years ago, another ballet director, Alexei Radmansky, left the Bolshoi Theatre, and he also says now that this is not surprising. We've seen a horrible development inside the walls of the Bolshoi with all these inside intrigues. So there's a lack of theatrical ethics inside the Bolshoi Theatre. That's what he said. And, well, this last incident, this horrible attack with the sulfuric acid on Sergei Filin is, of course, worse than all the previous incidents, but it definitely does cast a serious shadow over the reputation of the Bolshoi.
I believe the Bolshoi has had 5 artistic directors in the last 15 years or so. I mean, the ballet world is, of course, very competitive. But do these intrigues at the Bolshoi somehow reflect the Russian mentality and way of doing things?
Well, there are some people who say that what's happening inside the Bolshoi Theatre is in fact a miniature copy of what's happening in Russia as a whole. There may be, well, a bit of an exaggeration. As said, of course, this theatre world, the ballet world, is a very particular world of its own, with all these little egos, people who really want to prove themselves, and with only a limited number of big roles available, you get an enormous competition, and that sometimes leads to all kinds of acts of hooliganism by just putting paint on costumes or doing things which can make the other person look ridiculous just to damage his or her image. So I think these are things that are really specific to the theatre world, the ballet world. But on the whole, of course, if you look at the wider picture of what's happening around the Bolshoi, you have the inside theatre and ballet things, but also around the Bolshoi, you have this whole mafia of ticket sellers, you have the strange fanatic fans of dancers who are in fact willing to do everything in order to make their particular idol become, well, the head dancer in one or other ballet. So it's a whole world indeed of very strange groups of people which I think indeed do reflect in some way Russia as a whole.
Are there any indications as to how the management of the Bolshoi is trying to limit the damage to its reputation and also morale?
Well, for now, they're keeping a very, very low profile. And I just heard on the radio the comment of one of the executives of the Bolshoi saying, well, we just don't know exactly what happened. She said she refused to believe that it's only a conflict about a ballerina, about a woman. There must be more about it, because in the past years already, Filin and others have been receiving threats by telephone and in other ways. So they're keeping a low profile. They don't want to say anything until the investigation has progressed. And for now, they've only announced that they already have found a replacement for Pavel Dmitrychenko in the Ivan the Terrible ballet, and also the Sleeping Beauty ballet, which is due on the 16th of March.
And that was our correspondent Gert Kerkamp speaking there from Moscow. While the US continues to discuss new gun control measures, Europe's new gun laws are beginning to go into effect. The EU has called on all member states to create national gun registries by 2014. Germany, which already has one of the world's lowest rates of gun deaths, was one of the first countries to bring its database online, doing so in January. Michael Scaturo looks at how the new system works.
I'm standing on one of Berlin's premier shopping streets, Friedrichstrasse, in front of a luxury sporting goods store called Franconia. Inside, fancy riding and hunting costumes sit next to high-powered rifles, shotguns, and pistols. But new EU laws are making it harder for people to buy weapons legally in stores like this in Germany. Berlin's State Office of Criminal Investigation issues gun licenses in the German capital. Most applications take 3 weeks to process, but Tatjana Meinert of the Weapons Control Office says not everyone can obtain a license.
Immer ein damit verbunden ist, dass man einen bestimmten Grund dafür haben muss.
People who want to apply for gun licenses need to have a good reason, and the reasons are quite specific. Marksmen in shooting clubs and hunters can apply for licenses. And then there are special cases, security guards and people who protect armored vehicles. Sometimes people can apply to own a gun if they're under a specific threat, but most people can't just walk in here and say, I think I need to protect myself, and expect to get a license.
On January 1st of this year, Germany's new National Gun Registry went online. It tracks both weapons and their owners. Germany is also requiring psychiatric evaluations for people under 25 who want to buy a gun. People with a history of mental illness, drunk driving violations, and domestic abuse infractions are not granted licenses. Meinert says even a person who has been approved for a license can lose it.
Jemand wird krank oder eben auch jemand wird in irgendeiner Form straffällig.
We often see cases in which someone becomes ill or commits a crime. In those cases, we seek court permission to take back the license, and the person will have to give back the weapon.
The school day had only just begun when the attacker struck. Tim Kretschmer, a former student, had taken one of the 18 guns that belonged to his parents and began firing.
We're going to get to one of our top stories now. We're talking about this shooting in Germany where 15 people were killed.
Gun laws here were tightened significantly after 2009 when a deranged 17-year-old went on a shooting rampage, killing 15 people at his school in Winnenden, a small town outside of Stuttgart. Winnenden radically changed Germany's relationship with guns. Just as in the Newtown, Connecticut massacre in the U.S., the Winnenden killer had obtained his weapon from his parents' house. In a landmark ruling, the boy's father was later convicted for not properly locking away his weapons. Hardy Schober lost his 11-year-old daughter, Jana, in the Winnenden massacre. Since then, he's been campaigning for tougher gun controls in Germany.
Wir haben dort in dieser Anhörung auch ein Verbot der großkalibrigen Waffen gefordert.
In hearings, we demanded a ban to high-caliber weapons, but that failed. A compromise was eventually reached, and it called for random checks in the homes of shooters to make sure they are locking up their guns. This became part of the German gun law, and it makes gun ownership safer for everyone.
So unlike the US, the German government has clamped down on gun owners. Now they can be fined if officials believe the weapons are being stored carelessly. Tatjana Meinert again.
Muss es auch nachweisen, er kann Fotos darüber einschicken, sofern noch vorhanden Rechnungen oder Lieferscheine, dann da kopieren und einschicken.
People can send us pictures of gun lockers or receipts or delivery statements to prove that they are in compliance with the law. But we reserve the right to check in person to see if the weapons are in fact being locked up securely.
With 1.4 million gun owners possessing an estimated 5.5 million guns, most German gun owners will never be checked. Friedrich Gephardt, president of the German Sport Gun Owners Association, says he's in favor of stricter laws, but doesn't like the spot checks.
They don't have to tell you in advance they will come. So they can just come in the morning, 8 o'clock, ring at your door and say, we want to look at your firearms.
But Hardy Schober, whose daughter was killed at Winnenden, rejects Gephardt's assessment.
When the checks are random or unannounced, people lock up their guns. When they aren't, people leave guns lying around in their bedrooms or living rooms.
As traumatizing as the Winnenden massacre was for Germany, the country has one of the lowest rates of gun crime in the world. About 160 people were killed by guns in Germany in 2010, according to the website gunpolicy.org. By comparison, 32,000 people were killed by guns in the United States that same year. Meinert and her agency hope to reduce the German death rate still further with the help of new background checks and gun databases. Eventually, that database should contain enough information to allow police, who find a gun at a crime scene, to discover where the gun was made, who owned it, and where it was sold. Michael Scuturo, DW, Berlin.
Well, everyone likes their local community to be peaceful and orderly, especially at night. But people also like to go out and party, especially the young. So, how do you both keep the peace and the nightlife? Imogen Folks reports from Switzerland, where new laws are causing rage among young people.
Now, you see, here is a park, and there are a lot of places here for all the people. And in summer, it's really nice here, and you see the mountains from here.
Hans-Peter Buhlmann, community police officer in Interlaken, is showing off a highlight of his town, a park with green open spaces and stunning views of the Alps. But recently, Officer Buhlmann's idyll has become flawed.
And here's the place, open, full of people in summer, and people sit down and drinking beer and alcohol. And what's the problem here?
Now Interlaken has a solution to all those young people in the park, a law which says they have to stay at home.
In every town you can see teenagers or young people to drinking beer and other things. But it is not a thing we like to see here in Interlaken, it's clear. After 10 o'clock in the evening, young people under 16 years are not allowed to visit the public streets alone. Only with parents, it's possible that young people, teenagers, can visit the town.
Jugendliche unter 16 müssen nach dem 10 daheim sein. Das Kehrsatz halten sich gestern Abend.
Across Switzerland, curfews for the young are being introduced and making headlines. Felix Graf of the Young Socialist Party believes it's a worrying development.
That's everywhere in Switzerland the same problem. There are a few different laws, but absolutely it's a trend. The young people, they want to do things, but then the older people come and say, no, that's forbidden, you mustn't do that. And it's always a little bit the same topic.
The latest community to impose a curfew is the little town of Kehrsatz, just outside the capital, Bern. Mayor Katharina Annan explains.
Es war laut. Es hat zerbrochene Flaschen am Boden gehabt.
We had problems with noise, with broken bottles, damage to the benches outside the kindergarten, lots of things vandalized, street lamps broken, all that kind of thing.
But now young people are fighting back, braving sub-zero temperatures to stage an outdoor after 10 at night party.
I think 10 o'clock is really early, and the parents are responsible for their own children, and such rules are not necessary, they only give new problems.
Es ist recht überraschend gekommen, das Gesetz, und ich finde es echt schade, dass man das uns verbietet.
This new law is a huge surprise. We're really disappointed. Lots of us have friends over 16. We go out with them. Why do we have to go home at 10, just when the fun's starting?
And I don't think you need to be 16 to be able to stay out until 10 o'clock. Maybe a younger age.
I think that new rule doesn't make any sense.
The big question for both young people and their parents is, how will these curfews work? What happens to a 15-year-old coming out of the cinema or a football match at, say, 10:15? The answer, private security firms. Some, like the Broncos, with dubious backgrounds.
The start of our company is actually a motorcycle club, which is called Broncos Motorcycle Club, Broncos MC. It's an MC like Hells Angels, Bandidos, Outlaws, whatever you know.
Nowadays, insists Broncos manager Roland Steiner, the security firm and the motorbike club are completely separate, and his security officers are professional, friendly but firm.
We talk to them, what are you doing, where are you going, have they alcohol bottles with them, how old are they. We ask them, do you have a passport, ID, can we see this? And most of the time we get it, because we do it on a friendly way. It's just, if you provoke us, there's a limit. And if you go over the limit, there's the end.
But there's no sign that Swiss teenagers are prepared to accept this as the end. Last summer, 20,000 of them partied all night long in Bern in a street demonstration called Dance Yourself Free. Felix Graf again.
It was a demonstration for more room, for more free time, and for the spaces for younger people in Switzerland. And it's a very strong sign of the younger people that they don't want to be all the time affected by the police, and they don't want new curfews.
This summer, Dance Yourself Free will happen again. Tens of thousands are expected. But all the while, more towns are introducing curfews, and Switzerland's usual harmony is becoming a little strained. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bern.
And I'm Helen Senian Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Tuesday marked the 50th anniversary of the death of Joseph Stalin. The Soviet leader was one of the most controversial figures of the 20th century, responsible for millions of deaths. But in his home country of Georgia, Stalin continues to command respect. Paul Rimple has been finding out more in Stalin's hometown of Gori.
It's a freezing, windy afternoon in Gori.
Snow flurries fall and a few dozen people gathered in front of the little wooden house where Joseph Stalin was born. The hut forms the centerpiece of a museum dedicated to Stalinism. Some have traveled across the country to pay tribute to him. Most are poor pensioners. They hold red flags and a communist banner and take turns speaking through a small megaphone. Mikhail Tijaradze has traveled for 8 hours to be here.
I came from Ajara. I come here every year to mark the day of Stalin's death and the victory of World War II. We working-class people see him as a person who improved working-class life and brought it to a different level. He wasn't just the leader of Georgia, he was a world leader. And as a leader, he was about freeing the working class in general, helping those in need and bringing hope and prosperity, not just to Georgia, but to the world.
In Western history books, Stalin industrialized the USSR, but he is seen as a brutal dictator responsible for perhaps 30 million deaths through execution, imprisonment, and starvation. In Georgia, those deaths don't register. Stalin is a hometown hero and for many a national icon. A new poll by the Carnegie Endowment notes that 45% of Georgians expressed a positive view of Stalin and 68% call him a wise leader. Alexander Rondelli is the director of the Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies.
There are many people still, among our generation mostly, who do not understand the difference between famous and notorious. For them, Stalin is the most prominent, at the same time the most notorious Georgian. So they prefer to have someone very known instead not to have anyone. But new generation does not like him. People know that he was dictator, he was butcher, and he brought disaster to his small nation.
Rondelli says that unlike Germany, which established a policy of denazification after World War II, post-Soviet countries never underwent a similar policy after the fall of the USSR. However, over the past few years, Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili introduced anti-communism and anti-Stalin campaigns. For example, the creation of a museum of Soviet occupation in Tbilisi, and the removal of Soviet symbols from buildings and statues of Stalin scattered around the country, including a 6-meter Stalin statue in front of Gori City Hall. But when the president's party was defeated in parliamentary elections last October, people began replacing the Stalin statues, unopposed by the new government. Anti-Stalinist activists then paint-bombed these statues pink.
Saakashvili and his government launched this Stalinization. But they were doing it quite slowly, not to come across serious resistance. I think it was quite effective, but now whatever was done by government of Saakashvili is, you know, condemned as something, you know. Some people just restore Stalin statues in their private gardens or something like that. So I would not say that it's a re-Stalinization process at all. So nothing strange that so many people still look at him as an icon. You know, when times are difficult and poverty and justice, it's a paradoxically remember dictators who brought this in bigger scale.
Georgian scholar Lasha Bakradze says many Georgians still view Stalin favorably because no serious historical or political research has been conducted. The Museum of Soviet Occupation, he maintains, was set up with a propagandistic agenda and has not increased public knowledge about the Soviet era in general and the Stalinist period in particular. According to the Carnegie poll, almost a quarter of young Georgians have an indifferent attitude towards Stalin, while more than a quarter say they do not know who Stalin is. Back in Gori, a group of children tour the Museum of Stalinism. Teacher Diana Tsotskiashvili has brought her class here to better understand the legacy of their fellow Gori native.
We're here because it's March 5th, the day Stalin died. We brought the pupils so they can learn about him. He was born here, and the kids need to know where he's from and what he did and so on. When the children grow up, they have to decide for themselves what he did that was good and what was bad.
The phenomenon of Stalin's popularity is not just Georgian. In Russia, attitudes towards him have improved since the fall of the Soviet Union. Many see a correlation between the rehabilitation of Stalin and President Vladimir Putin, who embraces symbols of authority and national strength. But in Georgia, it's different. Georgians aren't concerned with Stalin's politics. What's important is that Stalin was Georgian. Paul Rimpel, DW, Tbilisi.
Africa's most prominent rappers is urging people not to dismiss the Democratic Republic of Congo as a hopeless case. The rapper, Baloji, currently lives in Belgium, which used to be Congo's colonial master. Despite his homeland's bloody past and volatile present, he's using his songs to encourage audiences to give his homeland a chance. Baloji has just been performing in Denmark. Malcolm Brabant caught up with him in Copenhagen.
My country is an emerging continent, built up in less than 15 years. Give me a
According to music reviewers, Congo-born Baloji is one of the most talented rappers to emerge from Africa. His name means sorcerer, and he hopes that his brand of magic will win over audiences.
I think being a musician is a kind of strange state of mind because you want to be heard by people and you want to share your vision.
Baloji claims Congolese musicians are censored because there are no record labels and they rely on sponsorship from corporations that restrict the scope of their songs. As a resident of Belgium, he relishes the artistic freedom denied to his compatriots.
They cannot talk about any subject, especially some social or political subject, because they have to promote those company that pay for them to be heard.
Congo's civil war cost an estimated 5.4 million lives, and although peace has nominally arrived, the country's people are still the poorest on the planet. Here in Europe, Congo is seen as something of a lost cause, but Baloji believes in the potential of his homeland.
Et ton inspiration en dépend.
It's such a young country and things are changing because I see younger generations studying and trying to ask some real questions to politicians. You cannot say that it's a place with no hope. I think it's insulting because you're talking about a country that is 7 times bigger than France. So, of course, things are more difficult because they're coming from a history where everything gets split up. And it takes time for people to change.
Despite his popularity and growing international fan base, Baloji is modest about his ability to bring about change.
We have to give up this Bob Marley that I'm going to save the world with a beautiful song. I'm not into this state of mind, neither. You just do things that you think that is right for yourself and you feel like it's natural to do it. And I hope that people can take it as an example.
But if his concerts in Denmark are anything to go by, Baloji has the potential to convert thousands of music lovers to his brand of hope. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Copenhagen.
That's all we have time for. Thanks for joining us this week, and I hope you enjoyed the program. It was produced with help from Connor Dillon and sound engineer Mike Eckert. And I'm Helen Sini. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.